The final investigator I chatted with was Dr. David Carbone, and to begin our conversation, we talked about recent data attempting to identify patients with wild-type non-small cell lung cancer who benefit from EGFR TKIs, specifically the Virostrat assay.
The idea behind that test was to try to determine with a minimally invasive test, in this case a blood sample, whether you could distinguish patients who would benefit from EGFR-targeted therapy. And it's very clear that patients with the receptor mutations benefit from the therapy, at least transiently. They all become resistant. But there's, I think, abundant evidence that some subset of lung cancers that don't have detectable EGFR mutations have some benefit in the range of several months of minimal responses or progression-free survivals with EGFR-targeted therapies. And so we determined a protein signature that was able to separate good and poor survivals in patients treated with this drug. And we have a paper in press right now looking at the samples from BR21, which was a randomized trial of EGFR TKI versus placebo done by the Canadians a decade ago that showed survival advantage in unselected patients. But if you look at the subset of patients that got, and we tested the blood in those patients that was available for research, if you look at the subset of patients that have the protein signature we identified, they had a median survival of 10.5 months. And without that signature, the median survival was 3.9 months. And so it did seem to give prognostic information in patients that were on this clinical trial, treated with erlotinib, and identify the ones that had the better survival.
Now, were these EGFR wild tumors?
They didn't test the majority of the patients in this study for EGFR mutations. And so we don't really know the answer. And a subset of these patients that we identify with this protein signature is 60% of the patients had the good protein signature. And in a Western population, no more than 10% of patients have EGFR mutations. So clearly, the signature is not dependent on EGFR mutation status. And in fact, in this study, it was statistically not correlated with EGFR mutations. And the objective responders in this study, I think there were 19 objective responders and 18 of them had the good proteomic signature, and that was a statistically significant predictive factor for response. So the conclusion was that it may, in certain circumstances, patients with wild-type EGFR be able to identify subsets of patients that have better survival. And it's being tested, interestingly, actually, there are data that squamous cell cancers may have an even better discrimination than adenocarcinomas. In one unpublished set that we have, there was a six-fold difference in median survival of squamous patients treated with erlotinib between the proteomics good and proteomics poor signature groups, so that if you remove the patients that have very poor survivals with erlotinib, you may be able to identify a subset of squamous patients that have really excellent progression-free and overall survivals with erlotinib. And that's being prospectively tested in a European randomized trial right now.
So is there any data right now out there where you have both the results of this assay, the Virostrat assay, as well as EGFR mutation, so that you're able to state in any way that it's, you know, helpful or predictive for EGFR wild?
There are several retrospective cohorts. We looked, for example, at the ECOG 3503 study. And again, even if you look just in EGFR wild type or unknown patients, there's still a separation for survival with this classifier. So I think that there are good data that even if you look in EGFR wild type patients, and most squamous patients are EGFR wild type, and virtually all of them are, and they have a very good separation for survival with this classifier. So I think that it is pretty convincingly true that this effect that we're seeing is not dependent upon occult or unknown EGFR mutations, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I mean, it's really fascinating. You mentioned the fact that it's a serum assay. I mean, we are getting more and more used to doing biopsies, but it's certainly a tremendous advantage to be able to do it on the serum. Can you talk more about the technology? It's like mass spectrometry or something?
Well, let me just make it very clear that I'm not saying that this test is, and I think it would be wrong to state that this test will replace EGFR mutation analysis. I think all patients with lung cancer should have a mutation analysis for EGFR and ALK and the other clearly targetable genetic abnormalities. I think that there are patients without, in fact, most patients in Western populations don't have demonstrated, clinically validated targets that can be found by genetic analysis. And so the purpose of our study was to find some marker that might correlate with benefit from EGFR TKIs.
I've heard the term triple negative now, triple negative lung cancer.
That's right. Yeah, we can talk about those, but except that's a mirror image of breast cancer. But the fact is that there are many more than three lesions in lung cancer now. So I think that you could say pan negative or deca negative or whatever you like. But in this case, this assay is a protein-based assay based on a mass spectrometry technology called matrix-assisted laser desorption ionization mass spectrometry. But it really is done only on a few microliters of plasma or serum. And in fact, they can do it by spotting the plasma onto a paper card and just mailing it off to the company. The other way you can use a peripheral blood is to look at circulating DNA. And there are companies that to look for mutations in circulating DNA. By using sensitive PCR technologies, you can pick up most patients with EGFR mutant tumors by looking in the peripheral blood for EGFR mutations circulating in the blood. And so that avoids the use of a biopsy in patients that are impossible or difficult to biopsy. And that's being investigated right now. That also allows the following of patients over time, because it turns out that the dominant mechanism of resistance to erlotinib is acquired mutations in the EGFR T790M. And if you can detect the emergence of those mutations with serial blood samples over time, that could be useful to predict relapse soon thereafter and potentially guide the addition of second or third generation inhibitors that may be better against that acquired mutation.
How close are we getting to these being sort of a clinical reality, something you can order commercially?
Oh, I think we're quite close. The technology for detecting circulating DNA is old technology. It's PCR. But making that into a reliable clinical test and to prove its efficacy is something that needs to be done, but it's definitely doable. And so I think that this technology could be available in the very near term.
Getting back to the VeriStrat, you know, this idea, when I kind of heard about it, I was like, it seemed like, hasn't somebody done that before? Has it been done a lot before? It seems like something that makes a lot of sense.
Well, many groups have tried it. One interesting fact was that early on in its development, we acquired a set of patients that had been treated with gefitinib, I think, and were analyzing those patients in my lab, and then independently, a laboratory in Colorado was using the same technology, but not the exact same protocols. And we began just talking to each other at meetings, and it turned out that we had received the same set of samples from the same group and were independently analyzing them for exactly this feature. And it turns out that we had a 97% concordance in the classification that we assigned to these patients, even though they were done completely independently, which is actually an incredible concordance considering things such as HER2 testing. The concordance between labs is often as bad as 80%.
I want to talk about your cases. Just a couple more things. I just want to follow up a little bit in terms of Chicago. And I know that the Point Break trial, a much anticipated study, phase 3 study, Jyothi Patel, was reported there. Could you just briefly summarize what they looked at generally, what the findings were, and what you think it means?
Well, the comparison there is the carbopaclitaxel Bev followed with Bev alone maintenance compared to carbopem followed by pem with Bev maintenance. And The carbopaclitaxel Bev arm is the same as the positive arm in ECOG 4599, but there are ample data that pemetrexed is an extremely active agent in non-squamous tumors, and many people think maybe a superior regimen to carbopaclitaxel. And the addition of maintenance pemetrexed has shown efficacy in PFS compared to maintenance with nothing. And so it was a very reasonable comparison to compare the ECOG 4599 regimen with a PEM-based regimen and PEM maintenance, in this case with Bev as well. And many people predicted that that PEM-Bev combination would be substantially better than Bev alone in maintenance. But the fact is that there was really no difference whatsoever, which is disappointing in that it would have been nice to have documented a regimen that's better than the ECOG 4599 regimen. But it actually would have been a very costly regimen given the fact that it had both bevacizumab and maintenance PEM in the regimen. So I think it validates the ECOG 4599 data, but is disappointing in that it really doesn't point the way toward improving outcomes over that study, which is almost 10 years old now.
How do you assess the relative side effects and toxicity profile of the two regimens? Not so much the data, but in your own clinical experience.
Well, since I come from an ECOG institution, my standard regimen was the ECOG regimen. And so off protocol, I usually gave carbopaclitaxel bevacizumab maintenance according to that regimen. And in general, that's a fairly well-tolerated regimen. There are unfortunate examples of acute toxicities, such as hemoptysis or blood clots from the bevacizumab. But in general, it's well-tolerated and not an unacceptable regimen. Maintenance pemetrexed is also well-tolerated in this setting. It's just unfortunate that neither one results in dramatic survival benefits, and on average, just like I said before, only an order of a couple of months.
So let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 60-year-old man.
This is a patient that presented with a lung nodule and on staging evaluation, a bilateral hilar adenopathy, and subcentimeter contralateral pulmonary nodules were identified. And the PET evaluation showed that these were PET avid. And especially in certain parts of the country, there's a high prevalence of non-cancer causes of PET avid lymph nodes and pulmonary nodules. And so very often I see patients in consultation where a PET avid contralateral lymph node or pulmonary nodule were assumed to be metastatic disease, when in fact, if biopsied or investigated, were shown to be benign granulomatous or inflammatory lymph nodes. And I think that these sorts of patients, if mismanaged and assumed to be metastatic when in fact they were stage one, become self-fulfilling prophecies. If you treat them as metastatic disease, they die of metastatic disease, when in fact you've missed an opportunity to cure them by documenting metastatic disease. And so in my practice, I am very careful to document, if at all possible, metastatic disease that's suspected. And if impossible to document, we'll assume the curable situation and follow the undocumentable metastatic lesions so as not to miss a potentially curable case.
So he had a stage one cancer that was excised with lobectomy and node dissection.
And disease-free years later.
You mentioned, quote, certain parts of the country. What parts of the country? And what do you think the process is, the granulomas process?
Well, histoplasmosis typically. And it would be in central, middle United States and southeastern United States. It's very prevalent. Possibly up to half of patients who get CT scans in Middle Tennessee, where I practiced, would have pulmonary abnormalities that end up being just histoplasmosis. In fact, I had a pulmonary nodule resected that was histoplasmosis.
Really? Thoracoscopic?
Yes.
How was it?
how was the procedure?
Yeah. I mean, everybody sort of said, oh, yeah.
Unpleasant.
But
actually, I presented with superior vena cava syndrome and mediastinal adenopathy. And it turned out that I had a large cell lymphoma in my mediastinum, but the lung nodule was histoplasmosis. So I had chemo and radiation to the mediastinum.
Wow.
So I did have cancer, but the lung nodule was histoplasmosis.
Wow. When was this?
This was in 1999.
Wow. So was that pre-rituximab?
That was just as Rituxan had been demonstrated to have efficacy in follicular lymphoma and was being investigated in large cell. And they offered me to take it for my large cell, but I decided since it hadn't been proven that I would go without it, and I guess it worked out okay.
Wow. How was chemo?
Well, it's a long story.
I bet.
The adriamycin-based chemotherapy is not a walk in the park.
Did it change your perception as a physician?
Oh, absolutely. I know what a one-inch chest tube feels like and what surgeons under treating pain postoperatively feels like and just how bad you feel after chemotherapy. And I had chest radiation therapy as well. So I can sympathize with my patients in a lot of ways, though I usually don't bring it up because my average patient is a metastatic lung cancer patient who's not going to be cured. And there's a little bit of guilt in the fact that I am cured and they won't be, so I don't bring it up typically.
Anything about chemo that surprised you that you weren't expecting?
Well, I grew to hate IVs. That was pretty predictable, but I didn't think it would be as bad as it was. Inexpertly placed IVs can be extremely painful. The chemo itself, you talk to patients about how they feel, and they express, well, I have nausea or I have mouth sores. But it's very difficult to actually realize how miserable chemotherapy makes you feel. That is not readily describable. It's just a very tired, very unpleasant experience. And the mucositis, for example, from adriamycin is end to end. It's not just oral, and it's also difficult to describe how unpleasant it is.
I was just flashing a few years ago, we did a closed audio roundtable recording of, I think it was 9 physicians, oncologists, radiation oncologists, and urologists who had prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really amazing how their perception of the disease changed when they became a patient.
Well, I think it makes me more empathetic. I'm not sure I can treat the cancer any more effectively, but I listen better, I think.
I bet. Let's talk about your 65-year-old lady who was a never-smoking person who was a Jehovah's Witness with stage 1 lung cancer.
Well, that lady was a remarkable lady. She presented with a resectable lung cancer and then recurred in her lung with another resectable lesion and then developed multiple brain metastases that were initially resected and treated stereotactically. And this all happened over the course of quite a few years. And throughout all this, she received no systemic therapy. I think it was approximately 10 years that we managed her with local therapy measures for local disease. And she was very minimally symptomatic once treated. The brain metastases were caught early, and once treated, she had no central nervous system symptoms, and her pulmonary status was excellent, and so we didn't feel like it was necessary to even try chemotherapy. However, after about 10 years, she's developed multi-site progression, bilateral adrenals, bilateral lung nodules, and we figured it was time for systemic therapy. And I realized that I had never done genetic testing on her since I had continuously been seeing her for a decade and before mutation testing was even considered. And so we did find an archival sample of her tumor and we determined that she had an EGFR mutation. And she was starting to feel very poorly. And we put her on the erlotinib and she had a miraculous return to normal and her tumor shrank dramatically. And she felt very well for quite a few months, then started slowly progressing, feeling bad again on the erlotinib. And so I thought, well, we should go with chemotherapy. And she tolerated carboplatin Bev incredibly poorly. neutropenia, anemia. Her hemoglobin went down to 7 or 8, and she's a 65-year-old. And obviously, as a Jehovah's Witness, she was refusing transfusions. So she received only a couple of cycles of chemotherapy before absolutely refusing any more. We ended up putting her back on erlotinib, and she had another partial response. But I think the message there is that there's no formulas for lung cancer, and you have to look at each patient as an individual. And if a patient is truly a palliative intent patient, where you know you're not going to cure them, if they have multi-site disease, and yet they're completely asymptomatic with minimal bulk disease, with no impending medical urgencies, I'm completely comfortable with treating metastatic disease with local therapies in selected cases. I have other cases where I've managed metastatic disease with local therapies that have gone more than 10 years before needing systemic therapy. And if we had jumped on systemic therapy 10 years earlier, it's highly likely that we may have shortened her life with that approach, given her intolerance and her Jehovah's Witness status. And so I think that we have to be sensitive to the range of biologies that lung cancer has. In some cases, dramatically progressive systemically, that demands systemic therapy. But in other cases, it pops up here, it pops up there, can be treated locally, and local therapy for local disease is sometimes better for the patient, even though that's not what they teach you in textbooks.
Well, I've got to say, too, you know, I've chatted with a lot of lung cancer investigators, and I think you're the first person to bring this phenomena up. And as you described this case, I was thinking to myself, how many people have you seen like this? Because I don't remember hearing too much about this phenomena. I mean, how often do you see it?
We see it fairly often. The difference is, I think that the average practitioner will say, this is metastatic disease, we have to give carbopaclitaxel bevacizumab, and that's what the NCCN guidelines are. And I think that in my 20 years of practice, I've determined that there's a, as I said, a range of biologies in lung cancer. And if you are sensitive to the fact that this exists and you are confronted with a patient who's asymptomatic from their disease, as minimal bulk, as I said, sometimes jumping on chemotherapy right away is not the best option for the patient, in my opinion anyway.
You know, as you were talking about that, I just sort of flashed on mantle cell lymphoma, where John Leonard and others, you know, people, you know, are hyper-CBAD, very aggressive treatment for that lymphoma. And yet he talks about, and others have been talking about, the fact that, again, as you say, there's a subset of patients who don't need that aggressive therapy. The other thing about this lady is, going back to the point where she had progressive disease after having a good response to her erlotinib, how do you generally manage patients like this nowadays? Are there situations where you'll continue their erlotinib and add in chemo? And what about new approaches like cetuximab, afatinib?
Right. Well, historically, I have not combined chemotherapy with erlotinib in these patients. When they progress on erlotinib, I'll stop and I'll try chemotherapy. And then I find that I often get a second response to erlotinib after they progress on chemotherapy. It's a question that's, I think, unanswered, whether you benefit a patient's survival by combining the two on progression from erlotinib in a mutated EGFR patient. I do not use the combination, just because I think that the data aren't there to support that, and I do see second responses. Recently, in the last couple of years, there are new generations of drugs and combinations that are specifically designed for exactly the situation of acquired resistance to EGFR TKIs. And you mentioned afatinib cetuximab, and we at Vanderbilt had a study, and there you combine cetuximab, an antibody against EGFR, with an irreversible tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And we saw approximately a 40% objective response rate in patients actively progressing on erlotinib, which was quite remarkable. Now, that combination was significantly more toxic than erlotinib. But
sounds like it would be a dermatologic nightmare.
Well, but it was manageable in the majority of patients, and we would hold cetuximab if they had a bad skin problem. But cancer is bad for you too, and these patients did have significant symptomatic relief from this combination that lasted a significant period of time.
Amazing waterfall plot, too.
Yes.
And, you know, you see that, and, you know, people, particularly after they've had a response, you know, they see this has happened, are desperate. You know, physicians are desperate. But, I mean, is there any trial out there right now that you can get patients on that combination?
Oh, our trial is closed, though I don't think at this moment there is a trial available for that combination, though I think the company is trying to get approval in that setting, and hopefully that will happen pretty soon, because I think this is a dramatically effective combination.
And before, you were talking about sort of things geographically, and how did cetuximab go in your neck of the woods?
Well, there was a study a while not too long ago by Christine Chung at our place, who noted that the anaphylactic responses with cetuximab were much more common in our population than they were in California or in Boston, in fact, up to 30%, and determined that it was a regional allergic reaction because of a cross reaction with some local allergen that predisposed people to this kind of anaphylactic response to a particular sugar epitope on the cetuximab molecule. So we use it with trepidation in that part of the country.
So in this trial, did you see any major problems?
In this trial, I don't recall. I had several patients on it personally, and none of them had significant problems.
And my understanding is you don't see this with panitumumab?
No, it's very specific for a particular sugar epitope on the cetuximab molecule.
But I guess, do we know anything about panitumumab in lung cancer?
I personally don't know.
Interesting. Why don't we talk about your last patient, the 60-year-old farmer? I thought this was a pretty good story.
Yeah, this guy, well, he presented with a lung mass, and that was resected, but then he developed a brain metastasis, and that was resected as well, and he did very well for close to a decade afterwards, even though he continued to smoke the entire time and died of something else. So again, it points out that there's different biologies in lung cancer, and the isolated brain metastasis situation is definitely a potentially curable situation in lung cancer.
What was the histology?
In his case, I am not 100% sure, but I think it was adenocarcinoma.
But the bottom line is, he gets his tumor resected, stage one, 6 months later has a brain met resective, and then goes fine for 10 years. You're not just going to say that he died of another cause without saying what the cause is, are you?
Well, he was a Kentucky farmer, and he was taking care of his cows, and one of them kicked him in the head, and he developed an acute brain hemorrhage and died from that with no evidence of disease progression. And obviously his wife was devastated, but the fact is that he had 10 years of good quality life because we aggressively treated both sites of disease. Again, this is a similar scenario to the first case, but this was a curative intent situation.
So basically you cured him, I guess.
Yeah, all effects and purposes.
Yeah, you know, anybody, I guess, get cancer, that'd be their ultimate dream. If you have to die, I guess this is the way to do it pretty quickly, huh?
Yeah, I often tell patients that my goal is to get them to die of something else besides cancer.